You're listening to Leaning Toward Wisdom, the podcast, Modern Tales of an Ancient Pursuit. It's part philosophy. It's part sociological observation. It's a journal, if you please. Thoughts and insights. My name is Randy Cantrell. I am your host, and the website is leaningtowardwisdom.com. It's episode 5040. Welcome inside the Yellow Studio, coming to you from Dallas-Fort Worth, Texas. Today is Friday, August the 30th, 2019. Better to be alone than in bad company. George Washington said it. Good stories have villains, enemies, antagonists. I mean, good stories always have a protagonist, you know, a champion, one who is hated by the villain. One constantly under besiege of the evil. Which are you? Do you know? Winston Churchill said, "You have enemies? Good. That means you stood up for something. Sometime in your life." Winston was right. You know, Winston was right about so many things. What a brilliant, brilliant guy, right? I mean, I love reading stories about Churchill and great leaders of that ilk. In my insomnia, I've recently been binge-watching the Masterpiece Theater. It was on PBS. I guess it may still be. I didn't know anything about this, but it was late one night, and this was a month or so ago, and you may watch this series. If you don't, I would recommend it. It's a series called Poldark, P-O-L-D-A-R-K. It's a fellow's last name. Actually, it's a family's last name. It's a classic story set in Old England. Speaking of Winston Churchill, older England than that, though. Where there is a very clear hero, and there is an even more clear villain, enemy. The villain, his name is George. George is just the most despicable character that you would ever imagine. George, he came from humble beginnings, but he came to wealth, and so now he's trying to be a gentleman, right? He doesn't have the bloodline, but he's kind of wanting it to start with him, and he's just this despicable character. He is intent on doing whatever he can to disturb the life of this hero. The hero is Captain Poldark. He's a vexing sort of fellow, George, this villain. I'm very sure from his perspective, he's just constantly, it's clear from the storyline, he is constantly being persecuted by the good guy. I mean, his life would just be grand, except Captain Poldark is just this dark cloud over his life. The truth is, he likely sees himself as a good guy despite his conniving, evil, horrible actions. And I've been watching this story, and as it has unfolded over the course of a few seasons, there are currently 5 seasons, and I'm told season 6 is soon to drop, and I think I'm somewhere in the early part of season 4. The hero just continues to show himself to be a man of strong conviction, strong character. He's unwavering. He's unyielding. I mean, this is a guy, he bends to no one. He is a man of integrity. He is willing to fight whatever fight must be fought. You know, it's the whole Braveheart kind of a spirit. In the story, like all great stories, lots of tension, a little bit of romance, lots of uncomfortable moments. Well, kind of like your life, right? Kind of like my life. Enemies, opposing sides, people without compassion, opposing people who are driven by compassion, evil people behaving poorly, good people behaving with valor and honor. Well, okay, most of the time. But even the good guys, They show signs of great weakness under the strain of life. They prove themselves to be mere mortals like all the rest of us. They're human. They're human. They are not always able to hold it together. Sometimes they transgress. You know, it's a great series. It's a lot of betrayal, a lot of heartbreak, a lot of love and romance and sentimentality and passion and hatred and bitterness and jealousy and resentment and, yeah, everything else that you've likely got to some degree in your life, some probably more than others. I would hope that all of those good things, I would hope that your life has mostly those, far more heavier weight than those that are bad. Abraham Lincoln said, "Nearly all men can stand adversity, but if you want to test a man's character, give him power." Character. I guess that really is what we're talking about, at least right now. Character. Character. The development, the possession, the growth of character. The courage to do the right thing in spite of it all. There's a line from Harper Lee's book, To Kill a Mockingbird. "Real courage is when you know you're licked before you begin, but you begin anyway and see it through no matter what." That's great, right? Man, I wish I could write like that. Real courage is when you know you're licked before you begin, but you begin anyway and see it through no matter what. I don't claim to have expert insights on these matters. Mostly I just have curiosities, wonderings, and ponderings. And today's episode is not going to be as long as the previous couple have been, but you know me, if you've listened at all. And if you haven't, then welcome. I'm glad that you're here. I'm glad you clicked play, and I hope you will subscribe and tell your friends. But Helen Keller had a great quote, "Character cannot be developed in ease and quiet. Only through experience of trial and suffering can the soul be strengthened, vision cleared, ambition inspired, and success achieved." I'm glad I've got my sight. I sometimes wish I had Helen's insight. Character cannot be developed in ease and quiet. Only through experience of trial and suffering can the soul be strengthened, vision cleared, ambition inspired, and success achieved. I think she had it right. Well, I know she had it right. Character isn't built by luxury. It's not built by opulence or ease or entitlement. I'm curious mostly about the beginnings of character. You know, that spark that begins it, or that lack of a spark. When I was a boy, I loved creatures. Lizards, horned toads, frogs, turtles. These were among my favorite. I was not a bug kid, but I loved those kinds of creatures. And one of the most appalling behaviors that I witnessed as a little boy were kids who would mistreat these creatures. And I was always very careful with them. I wasn't interested in removing them from their home or the place where I found them. And I handled them with great care so as not to harm them. A turtle was found one day in a nearby creek. And as he crawled along the driveway, we clearly had removed him from the creek. An older boy appeared. He had a BB gun, and he began to shoot this turtle in the head. And I was horrified. I was angry. And he laughed, and he kept shooting. Blood all over the driveway. He eventually killed this poor turtle. And as you might imagine, the boy was a bully of a kid. He was a despicable human being. I have never forgiven him. And I was in elementary school. Today, I have a grandson, and my grandson, Easton, he loves these creatures. He's fond of capturing them and carting them off. Now, around my house, I've got a rule. No lizards, and we have many, no lizards are to be removed. Not from my yard. And when he captures them, they're to be returned to the general vicinity where he found them. I don't want them separated from their family. I don't know if they have a family, but I rather like to think they do. His parents have no idea, unless they're listening to today's episode. They have no idea. I've never talked of this. They have no idea of my deep-seated beliefs and feelings and how long and how strongly I have held these views of lizards and horned toads and frogs and turtles and leaving them and keeping them safe, is this a small thing? It is a small thing. Well, or is it? And where does it come from? I've often wondered. I don't know. I don't have an answer. Why was the older boy able to just immediately think of a BB gun? I'm going to get a BB gun. I'm going to kill this helpless turtle. A thought that would have never crossed my mind. Not that I had a BB gun, but if I had, it wouldn't have crossed my mind. And why did he gain such pleasure in it? I mean, what was causing me great anguish and great pain and still does to this day, countless decades later? Yeah, they can be counted, but who's counting? And he just took great glee in it. I was in grade school when I learned to discriminate. That is, to be picky about people that I chose to be around. Well, I know it happened in first grade, if not before. Certain kids were obviously ill-behaved and troublemakers. Now, me, I admit that at the beginning, I was probably just fearful of being dragged into trouble myself, because I quickly saw these kids as threats to, well, they were potential threats to my own safety, my own well-being. And I was highly motivated to avoid the wrath of my mother. My father was not so much a disciplinarian, but my mother was rigid. Willow trees provided great switches. Yeah, Google that if you're too young and you don't know what a switch is. If you're my age or older, you know what a switch is. It's that device that served as an effective deterrent to any mischief that you might want to be tempted to get yourself into. Yeah, you'd get whipped with a switch. I don't know. Was it upbringing? Was it something just, is it something that's given to us at birth? These inclinations, these tendencies, these traits. And why do I think some people are bad company, but other people can gravitate toward those same people that, to me, they're bad company? I mean, is it that whole birds of a feather kind of a thing? What personality, what character traits make you judge somebody as bad company? I've thought about this. Yeah, as you can imagine, I've spent countless sleepless nights watching Poldark and thinking about such things and listening to music. How do you manage bad people? I told you that I have a lot more curiosity than answers, and I just ponder stuff. I'm not coming to you claiming to know. Logically, I do know that some people, for whatever reason, have psychological, well, the world calls them disorders, and that certainly is accurate, I think. I'm fascinated by them, and I know enough to know that we don't fully understand why murderers are often convicted with compelling evidence against them. In today's day and age, all the scientific evidence that can be lodged against someone, including DNA, and yet at conviction, they are post-conviction. They show no signs of remorse. In fact, many, if not most, refuse to even acknowledge that they did it. And others among us are quick to fall on a sword and apologize for things that we didn't even do. We just feel bad because somebody needs to apologize. So, yeah, I'll step up and do it. I don't know. Those extreme differences are very bewildering to me. Have you watched or are you watching this series on Netflix, Mindhunter? It's a great series. Very graphic, but it's a great series. You know, these serial killers, and it's a launch into the story, somewhat fictitious, of the beginnings of kind of the whole FBI behavioral science division, where they were trying to figure out, why do these people do what they do? Why are these? In fact, they are the ones that came up with the term serial killer. Well, why do they do what they do? You know, perhaps even more fascinating to me are the people who appear or try to appear to be one thing, but in reality, they're something different, which is the case for all these serial killers. I mean, experts say that Ted Bundy, he was especially this kind of a character because, I mean, to look at it, he appeared clean cut. He was handsome. He was attractive. He seemed caring. He came from good family. He had all kinds of connections. Yeah, but he's a serial killer. Okay, thankfully I've not had the company, the bad company of a serial killer that I know of. I have, however, been in plenty of bad company, people with whom I do not feel safe. And for me, that's bad company. Bad company exists and consists of people with whom I just don't feel safe. People prone to dangerous behavior. Now, that beauty in the eye of the beholder and all that. People that are prone to have a negative impact on my life. People that just, they don't foster anything good for me. Company, influence, support. These themes have grown more important to me over the years as I have grown older. And the last decade, I can tell you, the last decade has been a personal journey of self-discovery. Just figuring things out, or better yet said, trying to figure things out. And in so many ways, in that regard, I guess it's been a monumental success. In other ways, it's very easy for me to tell you it's been a colossal failure. And maybe, well, there's no maybe about it. It has easily been the most difficult decade of my life. And yet I'm still optimistic and I'm hopeful. I mean, why not? I reached a point where I simply refused to give time and space to bad companies. I've always done it. I've always done it. I've always refused to give time and space to bad company. But, you know, as you get into adulthood, it's easier to do when you're a kid. And as you get into adulthood, there are people that you have to interact with. You know, you kind of have to be polite, even though you know that these are often despicable people. And maybe they're not despicable in some classic sense, but they're despicable to you. And I've just, over the last 15 years or so, I got to tell you, I've grown increasingly more intentional about it. I have purposefully shut out bad people from my life. And you know what? You don't have to be alone. You don't have to be alone. I know that the title of today's show, it really isn't a statement about the only options that are available. It's just a statement that as bad as it is to be lonely, and that's bad, it's worse to be in bad company. That really is the point. Thankfully, there is a much, much better alternative. And that is to make sure that the people who surround you are people who can help you become better and people that are willing to let you help them become better. And I've realized that there's one central thing that depicts bad company in my book. I figured this out. I can't tell you when, but I figured it out. And I've already alluded to it. And it also, I think, speaks to the character of people. It certainly is true in Poldark. It's true in every great story where there is a hero and a villain, and in great stories there always are. People with little or no compassion. People so self-centered that they aren't bothered by their betrayal of others. They're unfazed by the harm they cause others because, well, what they want is just more important to them. Nothing else matters to them except what they want. These are the people who have always comprised bad company for me. Kind of like that older boy with a BB gun killing the turtle. No compassion. I've been ruminating about this for some time. The other night at church, I gave a sermon that I entitled, "A Certain Samaritan Answers the Question, Who is My Neighbor?" You can read that story in the Bible for yourself, and if you're not a Bible reader, that's fine, but you ought to read this story. It's in Luke chapter 10, verses 25 through 37. And it's the parable that's most of us know it as the story of the Good Samaritan. And here's the long and the short of it. A man is traveling on a highway when robbers take advantage of him. They rob him, they beat him, they strip him, they leave him to die. One man comes by and ignores him. Oh, yeah, he sees this wounded man. He sees that he is in dire need, but he walks by on the other side. Well, another man comes by, and guess what? He does exactly the same thing. He walks by on the other side. Then the third guy walks by. Well, this third guy, the Lord says, is a Samaritan. And that's important to the story that he's a Samaritan because the question, "Who is my neighbor?" was asked of the Lord by a Jewish lawyer. And what he was hoping to do was trap or test the Lord with the question. And the Jews hated Samaritans. I mean, they even called them dogs. They didn't even think of them as human. So there's this enormous bias against this whole group of people, this whole race of people. So for Jesus to illustrate the answer by using a Samaritan, that's especially noteworthy. Well, the Samaritan has a quality that these other two men lacked, these other two passers-by. The Lord said so in verse 33, but a certain Samaritan, as he journeyed, came where he was. That is, he sees this wounded man, and when he saw him, here's the critical phrase, he was moved with compassion. He was moved with compassion. The difference in the story between good company and bad company, compassion. The good Samaritan, as we have all come to call him, we don't know his name, he had compassion. These other two fellows that walked by, they didn't. Compassion made the difference. Compassion still makes the difference. You know, I wish I could tell people how they can increase or how they can obtain compassion. I'm not real sure I can. I rather suspect that bad company are mostly people disinterested in it, or people who have fooled themselves into thinking compassion is something that's not, like judgment, harsh, critical judgment. You know, people that love to tell other people what to do. They love to express their opinion. They love to should people. Well, let me tell you what you should do. You should do this. You should do that. You should do this other. Why? Well, because I know everything. I know best. You're an idiot compared to me. My experience is that bad company is rooted in selfishness and arrogance. People who make bad company think they're smarter than all the rest of us. And they wonder how we could possibly get by in our life without their guidance and wisdom. I mean, that's the irony of it all. As we are working to lean more and more toward wisdom, bad company is convinced that if we would just bow to their will, we too could live more wisely. Mostly because we would make their lives richer, fuller, and more conceited. The parable of the Good Samaritan is a really sad story. And it's a sad story not because of the actions that he took, but because of the inaction of the other two guys who saw this opportunity to help this man, and they just ignored it. They couldn't be bothered. I mean, after all, there's nothing in this for us. Why should we do this? # selfishness. What's the lesson here? What are we to learn from this? Oh, I don't know. So many things. For starters, everybody has trouble. Everybody's a wounded man lying by the side of the road, half dead. That's true of us all. Nobody is free from care. Nobody's free from worry. Nobody is free from struggle or trial. Nobody. Next, whatever bravado, whatever courageous face people wear, it does not depict the truth. More often than not, it's a mask. We're hiding the real person, the fretful, worried, anxious person. And I get it. It's just kind of how we need to live our lives. I mean, come on, we're not going to go around and bemoan all of our troubles to everybody. Well, some people do, but most of us don't. And since the common plight of us all, it consists of wounds and pain and suffering, we ought to just be more compassionate toward each other, because we got a lot more in common than not. And we should be more forgiving. We should be less judgmental. But as I've often said, and I will continue to say, because it's proving itself to be truer and truer as life marches by for me, judgment is easy. Compassion is hard. But you know what else is easy? Comparison. Comparison is super easy. We look around and we instantly gravitate toward those who seem to have it better. Right? It's like the two men in the story that the Lord told who passed by on the other side. We can be just like those guys. Why? Well, oblivious to the people that are less fortunate. Oh yeah, we see them, but we don't pay attention to them. What are we fixated on? I'm fixated on the person that's got it better than me. I'm fixated on the person. Look at that Instagram post. Man alive, why can't that be my life? Sometimes I write prayers, true confession, just for my benefit. Yeah, sure, I'll say them out loud, but there are times when it just feels best for me to write it down and for me to get it, well, in black and white on the screen. And I'll often do these in Evernote so that I can pull them up. I did it this week. For the umpteenth time, I wrote a prayer. And I tend to focus the start of a prayer on gratitude. I don't think there's any secret formula to prayer, but it just feels right to me to first express thanks. No, I'm not going to share my prayer with you because, well, that just doesn't seem right. But I will share an idea, a snippet of it, because it's one important item that I think about quite often. And I find myself in private prayer using it repeatedly. I hope not too repetitive. And I have done this for many years. And I can't tell you where the idea had its genesis. We are approaching 8 billion people on the planet. Estimates are that over 1 billion people live on dirt floors. If you're not living on dirt floors, then congratulations. You're special. You're blessed. So am I. I wrote that in my prayer. Well, not just like that, but I told you I'm not going to read it to you. So put your imagination to work. I confess that I have written that many, many times. Almost 2 billion people on the planet, 2 billion out of nearly 8, do not have sanitary living conditions. Do you? Then you're blessed. We are approaching 2 billion people who live in poverty, and they suffer various and many facets of poverty, not just low income. That is, they lack education, they lack clean living conditions, they lack sufficient food. Do you? Well, then you're blessed. I think about the husband, I think about the father who last night lay awake fretful that his child lay dying, maybe his many children lay dying due to starvation, and he's helpless. He's absolutely helpless to do anything about it. He lives in a war-torn or impoverished or both place where food is scarce or non-existent. He goes to bed at night fretful, asking himself, what can I do? What can I do? And he gets up and that nagging question is still lingering with no good answer. He's hopeless. He's helpless. I'm not him. I'm not him, but I can't help but feel both blessed and compassionate. I'm thankful I don't face his realities, but I'm sad that he does. By his standards of living, I'm living in opulence. I am living in mega wealth. I am living in bliss. I'm not sure what I could do for him. I'm not sure what to do for him. I don't even know his name or where he lives or how I would begin to help him. I just know that there are hundreds of millions of hims out there languishing in despair. While I sit here inside the Yellow Studio talking into a microphone that likely costs more than he will earn in a year, and within 10 feet of me is running water, an indoor toilet, across the house, a fully stocked kitchen with enough food to likely feed him and his entire family for more than a month. Might be able to feed his whole village for a while. And I sit here right now alone, knowing bad company is worse than being alone. But I'm wondering if I'm bad company. Am I? I mean, it could likely be argued I am, but are we bad company because we're blessed? Are we bad company because we are more blessed? Well, not if we believe what the Lord was teaching in that story of the Good Samaritan. It's got nothing to do with need or want. It's got nothing to do with abundance or wealth or lack thereof. It's got everything to do with the heart. It's got everything to do with the mind. It has to do with our ability and our willingness to be compassionate. Empathy is a great, great thing. I'm blessed with an abundant measure of empathy. But empathy is understanding. Empathy doesn't do anything necessarily. Well, except help a person get it. Compassion is the horsepower. Compassion is the horsepower driven by empathy because compassion acts. Compassion does something. And yes, I know compassion does what it can, but it knows some things can't be done. I, in too many instances, have observed a person dying. I've been in the room with family when someone lay dying. I'm compassionate in attempting, poorly I might add, to console the living, but I'm powerless to do much of anything. I mean, what little I do it may help. It may not. I'm not sure. All I know is in those kinds of moments, I just try to think about them and not me. And I try to think about how they're wired, not how I'm wired. And what would best suit them, not me. I don't know what better thing to do. All I know is that in that moment, my inability is enormous. It's just huge. Well, I've got news for you. I have many huge moments like that. Moments of inability. Big, 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 big moments of inability. Moments that are just simply too big for me or my compassion. Yeah, like that dad, that husband living on dirt floors with starving kids. I'd like to think that I'd be good company for him, and I rather think I would be. I'm not sure exactly what that would look like, but from the comfort of the yellow studio, I think about him. I think about others like him. I pray. And I look inside. I look in the scripture, and I look to other guidance to leverage this plight, his plight, to at the very least make myself better. It's all an attempt to work on making sure that I'm good company. And in my efforts to become, well, even better company as time rolls by. It's not bad to be alone. It's better to be alone than in bad company. And there it is. Episode 5040, Leaning Toward Wisdom. It is Modern Tales of an Ancient Pursuit. There's nothing new here. As I said in the outset, these are just observations, philosophical moanings and groanings, more than anything, I suppose. But I'm glad that you click play, and I'm glad you're a subscriber. You can learn everything that you would like to and more at the website leaningtowardwisdom.com. If you are not inside the private Facebook group, consider this your formal invitation. Just go to the website, click on that Facebook icon at the top or the bottom of the page, and I will let you in. That's it for me. We're entering Labor Day weekend, so I hope everybody, at least in America, has a happy, safe holiday. And if you're not in America, well, maybe you should be. Oh, that's arrogant. I'm blessed. I'm blessed to be in America. You listening to the podcast have the technology in your hand to be able to listen to a podcast. So I know you're blessed. I know you're blessed. And no, I don't care wherever you are. I'm compassionate with whatever you're battling, whatever you're fighting. Thanks again for listening. And Lord willing, I'll talk to you next week. All right, you're still here. I'm still here. Project Craving Encouragement, I need your stories. I need your stories. I need your stories. I need your stories. You can visit the website leaningtowardwisdom.com/craving. leaningtowardwisdom.com/craving. And that will tell you how you can get to me your stories. Here's what I'm looking for, and I'm going to start incorporating these, the Lord willing, sometime in the month of September. I'm going to start building in a segment in each podcast where I share a story of encouragement. Just to give you just a thumbnail of the backstory, as I was sitting across from successful people, accomplished people, largely business leaders, it dawned on me many, 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 many months ago that leaders, especially leaders who are trying to build good cultures, right? I mean, they want a workplace where everybody's engaged and people are feeling good about themselves and putting in the work and achieving at a high level. And so every business person understands the importance of that. And in those kinds of conversations, I began to have a discussion about encouragement. And I would ask, do you understand what encouragement is? Well, everybody, of course, easily. Of course. Well, tell me about a time when you were really encouraged, where somebody did something, said something, and it really had an impact on you. I mean, it made a meaningful difference in your life. And people would think, and most, well, correction, everybody would hearken back usually to something in their childhood. The most recent that I ever heard was somebody who would mention something that happened 10 plus years ago at their very first job, maybe. But nearly everybody goes back to their childhood, which fascinated me. And they would tell me the story of a time when somebody, a teacher said something, a grandparent said something, and it made a big difference in their life. And they still remember it decades later. And I'm sitting here thinking, childhood? Really? You know, and I would often say anything more recent. And they would look around the room and they would think and they would bat their eyes and they would go, no, nothing that comes to mind. And I'm like, and yet you know what encouragement is like. Do you ever crave it? I found myself using the word craving. Well, of course, that had to prompt, you know, the brain to kick into gear. And I go and I register cravingencouragement.com. And I'm thinking, I don't know what I'm going to do with this, but I'm going to do something with it. Well, it turns out I'm going to make it a segment of the Leaning Toward Wisdom podcast. Craving encouragement. I've not yet met a human being that does not crave encouragement. And yet we are so, I don't know, we just rarely distribute it. We just don't do it. And rarely do we have it done to us. And it just baffles me. There's some things about it I understand, but there are many other things I don't understand about it. I don't know why we don't do it more. I don't know why it's so rare. But I do know why we crave it. So I'm collecting these stories. I'm hoping to collect these stories. You can do this any number of ways. You can send me an email. You can use the contact page. You can email me. It'd be great if you wanted to record it and send me your MP3. Come on, you got a smartphone. You know how to use the Voice Memo app. I mean, it doesn't have to be anything fancier than that. Just email me the file. I'd love to have it in your own words, and I'd love for you to be able to identify yourself. I realize I'm finding way too many people that want to be anonymous about this. That I don't understand that either. I mean, I get it. I'm empathetic, but I mean, really? Come on. We're all in this together. So I want your stories. LeaningTowardWisdom.com/craving. And just read how you can do it and follow the directions. And please, 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 I want your stories. All right, that's it for me. Greetings and welcome. I didn't say this. I threw you a curveball, didn't I, when we ended the show? Greetings and welcome inside the Yell Studio.